Today, the battle over dyslexia.
Having dyslexia, I just think it makes everything a bit more difficult. It's a messy place to be, I think.
Hope McGee is 26 and about to start her master's. She's always struggled with processing words.
With reading, it just means I'm kind of slower and I lose my place a lot. Like if someone says a new word to me, I don't really know what they're saying to me. I wouldn't know how to spell it. I always said I could absolutely not work at reception. Because, you know, when you pick up the phone and someone says their name, I'd be like, what did you just say?
She found school really difficult.
I loved reading always. As a kid, I would stay up like really late reading every night. But then when it came to the school environment, I think when there was time pressures on me, I hated it. When someone said there was an English lesson in primary school, I'd just try and run away. I'd dread it.
What no one was able to pinpoint was what was causing Hope to struggle. Until she reached university, when she was finally diagnosed with dyslexia that affects 1 in 10 people in the UK. Hope wonders if a different school with better resources might have picked up on her condition much earlier.
I went to a bit of a rugby school in my small town, which had like a behavioural unit. It's kind of where everyone would go if they got checked out the other schools. So I think there was always people with much worse problems and much more like debilitating problems than mine. So I think that's why it never got recognised. It's totally fair. Like, why would you send me for an assessment if you've got a kid with like severe ADHD?
The question of who gets diagnosed with dyslexia and who then receives support was one of the many that Guardian journalist Shirin Kale found herself examining when she began a year-long investigation into this learning difficulty. What surprised her most was how fiery the conversation around this condition had become, with some asking whether the term dyslexia should even exist. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why has dyslexia become so controversial? Shirin Kale, you've spent more than a year investigating questions around dyslexia, the science behind it, how people are diagnosed, who is diagnosed, and what treatments work. Let's start at the very beginning. When was dyslexia first identified and how?
Dyslexia was first identified in the late 19th century by a German ophthalmologist whose name was Rudolf Berlin. And he noticed that some of the patients that he was treating during eye tests struggled to read the letters on the board so often that he started to speculate that there might be a neurological reason for their difficulties in reading. And so he coined the word dyslexia, which means difficulty with words.
And how was it tested at the time?
At that time, researchers thought that dyslexia was something that manifests in otherwise bright people, people with normal IQs, high IQs even, who struggle to read. So the idea was that you take a person and you give them an IQ test, and then you give them a reading test. And if there's a discrepancy between where they are on their IQ test and where they are on their reading test, then you identify dyslexia. So the idea was that dyslexia was something that manifests when a person is reading at a level significantly below where they should be for their educational standards and age, even though they have a normal to high IQ.
And obviously that was a long time ago. Over the next 100 years or so, how did our understanding of dyslexia grow?
Throughout the 20th century, dyslexia became associated with people who ought to be able to read and write because they go to school, they have stable home lives, they're bright, they're smart, but for some reason, inexplicably, they cannot read. And so this myth, I suppose, that dyslexic children are smart children who can't read for some neurological reason was really commonplace in the UK and across the world until the 1990s.
What do you mean myth?
Educational psychologists now know that you can be dyslexic and have any IQ.
How did they start to understand more about dyslexia? Did you speak to people who were looking into this at the time?
Yes, I did. Jo Elliott is an educational psychologist by training. Jo was asked to write a book about children with special educational needs in the 90s, and he wrote a chapter on dyslexia. And during the course of writing that chapter, he reviewed basically every academic paper that had ever been written on dyslexia. And as he went through all of these papers, he found that no one had ever really been able to agree on a definition of dyslexia that worked. They knew that it wasn't related to IQ anymore, but all of the children and all of the adults with dyslexia they were profiling all seemed to manifest their literacy difficulties in different ways. There wasn't a coherent syndrome of dyslexia that could coalesce into having a uniform pattern of indicators.
This is the key question, the absolute key
What's the difference between a dyslexic and a poor reader?
Yeah, exactly. Given that they're both clearly poor readers.
And during the course of his research, Jo also looked at how you help people with dyslexia. So what is the best way to teach someone how to read and write if they're struggling? And what Jo realised was that actually you can teach a dyslexic person to read and write in the same way that you can teach a non-dyslexic person to read and write. It's the same approach. It's called phonics, which is basically where you sound out the letter sounds. And all academics pretty much agree that dyslexic people and non-dyslexic people can be taught to read and write in the same way. So Jo then asked himself, why are we spending money and time and resource diagnosing one subgroup of struggling readers, dyslexic readers, from another subgroup of people who also struggle to read and write, when the cure is the same for both of them? And I suppose that was his Newton's apple moment, where he really started to doubt the whole concept and scientific integrity of dyslexia as a whole.
It is the biggest scam I've ever come across. And it wouldn't matter if it didn't impact upon local authorities' capacity to meet the needs of all the kids who don't get the label.
It might have been a Newton's apple moment to him, but it sounds to me like he dropped a bomb into our understanding of dyslexia.
It wasn't received well. I have to say, though, I don't think Jo particularly minds the controversy around him. When I met him in the pub for our interview, I was a little bit taken aback by how this Durham University professor, who's also the master of a college at Durham, he swears more than any other academic I've ever met in my entire life. He's a bit of a kind of street fighter in an academic's garb.
And it was while I was writing that book that the penny really dropped, that it was all bollocks.
Okay, so he was standing firm, but what was the reaction?
When Jo first came out with his research, he published a book called The Dyslexia Debate in 2014. And I don't want to swear on this podcast, but it went down like a sack of X in the dyslexia community. By that, I mean advocates, activists, lobbyists, and also dyslexic people and dyslexic children and their parents.
Why did they feel so strongly?
So I think that goes really to the heart of this issue, which is that when you are someone who is dyslexic and you have struggled to read and write and it has had such a powerful and devastating impact on your life, and I mean that with absolute sincerity, it is utterly awful to not be able to read and write. Often dyslexic people feel like they're the class dunce, everyone's told them they're stupid their whole lives. It's a hard thing to have to go through. When you see someone like Jo Elliott saying dyslexia is not a real condition, you know, we should get rid of this label and this diagnosis and treat all people equally, regardless of whether or not they have this diagnosis, you don't really focus on his academic argument. You don't really look at all the papers that he's read and the sort of finer details of the points that he's trying to make. All you hear is someone telling you that your literacy difficulties, your dyslexia is not real. And you know it's real because you've experienced it your whole life. So there's a huge disconnect there, right? And that's understandably very upsetting. And that's why Jo has been vilified, I think, actually, by people within the dyslexia community. The people at the British Dyslexia Association referred to him as a climate change denier when I met with them. And I was pretty stunned by that, actually, because I went to an academic conference of all of the educational psychologists in the UK. It was run by the British Psychological Society, and they presented him with an Outstanding Achievement Award there. So clearly, there's a huge disconnect. I guess that was what was fascinating for me about this story.
And presumably, the reason people feel so angry is, as you say, that they want their persistent difficulties to be recognised. Does he accept that those persistent difficulties exist.
He absolutely accepts that. And I think this is really the aspect of Joe's argument that has been the most mischaracterized. And I think there have been people who've really operated in bad faith here. So the reason that Joe wants to get away with this need for a diagnosis, a need for someone to come in and test you and say, okay, you are dyslexic, here's this label that you can have, is because he sees it as a social justice issue, because there are people out there who struggle to read and write just as much as dyslexic people, but they're not getting this diagnosis. And so for Joe, it's about dismantling this system, this dyslexia idea that we currently have, in order to help as many people as possible who have literacy difficulties.
I think reading difficulties are real, absolutely. I've seen thousands of kids who have reading difficulties. And you know what? Very few are the ones I saw in the inner cities, in the kind of council states. Very few of them ever got diddly squat.
Do the people like the BDA explain why dyslexia has a very precise definition and a definition that might differentiate it to other literacy issues?
So there was a government review on this, the 2009 Rose review, and it defined dyslexia as a learning difficulty that affects the skills involved in reading and writing at the word level. So you look at an individual word and you struggle to comprehend what that word says. The BDA also tacked on some extra stuff to their definition of it. And they said that they might also have visual or auditory processing difficulties. So you might see the world in different ways. You might have different ways of processing information.
Obviously, you've mentioned that parents didn't like what Joe Elliott was saying. Are there academics who disagree with him?
There are academics who disagree with Joe. Professor Maddie Snowling at Oxford University is probably his most high-profile detractor, and she's very well respected. And she says, firstly, that dyslexia has a genetic component, but she also says that, most importantly, really, Joe's just been a bit of an iconoclast. He's just going around smashing windows that don't need to be smashed. Her son is dyslexic, and she said that she's seen firsthand how real and damaging dyslexia is. And she's also seen how labels could be very helpful for people, and they can really help them to understand why they feel like they're falling behind at school, why they feel themselves to be stupid. And so Maddie Snowling's approach is, let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Dyslexia is a label that's here to stay. It's very useful to a lot of people. Everybody knows what it means, really. And we don't need to just get rid of this label just because the academic research is a bit complicated around it.
Okay, so there was a huge reaction to his ideas, and he would argue that that was unfair. But did they have any impact in the way that dyslexia was actually being diagnosed and treated?
They have lately. They didn't for a long time. In the last couple of years, what we've seen is a few local authorities moving towards the idea that we should stop diagnosing some children with dyslexia and instead look at helping all children who have literacy difficulties, regardless of whether or not they have a dyslexia diagnosis, and treating them all equally. And I think it's really important at this point to emphasise that 1 in 5 people struggle to read and write. It's really commonplace. And within that, there's a subgroup of around 10% of people who are believed to be dyslexic. And some local authorities in the UK have been thinking, why are we spending so much resource streaming children when actually so many children are struggling with their literacy in our classrooms? How about we get rid of this dyslexia label and just focus on helping all of those children equally? And so in 2018, two local authorities in the UK, Staffordshire and Warwickshire, both said that they weren't going to differentiate between children with dyslexia diagnoses and those without dyslexia diagnoses, and instead they would treat all children equally. And they published some guidance to this effect, which contained a pretty incendiary sentence. I'm just going to read it out. And it said, it is widely accepted that the diagnosis of dyslexia is scientifically questionable. And that sentence, I mean, if Joe threw the first bomb into this field, that was definitely the follow-up grenade.
How do people react to that follow-up grenade?
Not well. Understandably, some parents in Warwickshire and Staffordshire suddenly felt like their dyslexic children weren't going to be treated fairly by this new system. And things got very heated when the British Dyslexia Association's president, Lord Addington, who is a Lib Dem peer, and he's also dyslexic. And he raised the Warwickshire and Staffordshire decision in a House of Lords debate in October 2018.
This states that dyslexia effectively isn't something to worry about. It effectively undermines the whole basis of the support which the noble lord has been talking about. Will he give us an assurance that the government will make sure that accurate diagnosis, which can be life-changing, is maintained for this group? Because it helps.
During the debate that followed, one peer asked whether Warwickshire and Staffordshire had also advised their residents that the Earth is actually flat and there is no such thing as global warming. I mean, that's pretty stern criticism of a local authority. And as a result of that intervention in the House of Lords from Lord Addington, both local authorities had to pull their guidance. And so that was the end of that, really. I should say that neither local authority were willing to talk with me for the piece. And when I asked one of their press officers why, he basically said, "We've had so much bad publicity on this. We just can't engage anymore on this topic. We need to move on."
I understand why the British Dyslexia Association would feel aggrieved about this, because clearly that diagnosis of dyslexia brings with it support to the people they think they represent.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point to make, actually, because when I first heard that explanation as to why we should keep a dyslexia label, I completely understood it. Of course, if you've been made to feel your whole life like you're stupid because you aren't where your peers are in your classroom, and then someone comes to you and says, "You're not stupid, you're dyslexic," that is such a powerful thing. And I'm sure that would boost your self-esteem tremendously. But then when you flip that logic on its head, well, what about the children who don't get that diagnosis of dyslexia? What about the children who aren't dyslexic, but they also struggle to read and write? Does that mean they are stupid and lazy? And when I started thinking about it like that, I came to the conclusion that every child should be told that their literacy difficulties are not their fault, regardless of whether they're dyslexic or not. Because firstly, it's incredibly common to struggle and read and write. And secondly, it's never anyone's fault. Something like that is never anyone's fault.
You've clearly waded into a controversial debate here around science, around definitions. Jo Elliott has been very outspoken and is clearly not worried about offending people. But it does sound like the key issue here, below all the noise, if you like, is the question of who, in the end, get support. Is it the case that better off parents are much more likely to get a dyslexia diagnosis for their children and then secure more resources for them?
So if you are a parent and you believe that your child has dyslexia and you think that your school and your local authority are not meeting your child's needs, what you can do is take your local authority to a special educational needs tribunal. That's under the 2014 Children and Families Act. And what that basically means is that you're suing your local authority for extra resource to address your child's special educational needs. Now, in itself, I think that sounds pretty reasonable. I think we should all agree that children with special educational needs should be given extra support and provision. Unfortunately, what tends to happen in these cases is that only the people who can afford to sue their local authorities do. In order to sue your local authority, you're probably going to need to have a private educational psychologist write a report on your child. The cheaper ed sites that are canvassed will probably charge about £300 for that, but a more expensive educational psychologist might charge £900, maybe more. And then on top of that, you're also going to have to find a lawyer who specialises in dyslexia cases. That in itself can be really expensive. I mean, the family of one dyslexic child that I spoke to who had gone through the tribunal courts and secured a placement for their child's dyslexia spent £10,000 in total. So necessarily what that does is it weeds out the people who can't afford to fight, or perhaps people who might not even be aware that these options are open to them. You know, people from low-income backgrounds, but also people who might not speak English as a first language, people who might be in abusive backgrounds, parents who might have drug or alcohol addictions, or just be working four jobs and not have the time to even notice that their child is falling behind on their schoolwork because they're trying to put food on the table.
Okay, so there's a growing industry of private diagnosis.
That was actually probably the most disturbing aspect of this whole story for me. There are people who are making very profitable livings from suing local authorities.
If dyslexia is missed, they will struggle, fail, and may never achieve their full potential. So don't let your child get left behind.
Independent educational psychologists, it's a fairly lucrative practice. Same thing for lawyers who specialise in SEN tribunals. And sometimes you wonder whether all these people who are telling these parents that they need to sue their local authorities because their local authorities are going to fail their kids, are they saying that because it's true, or are they saying that because they're going to get paid?
You mentioned one family that spent £10,000 to win their child a place at a private school that specialises in dyslexia. How much is the council in that case now paying in fees?
The local authority is paying £14,855 a year, and that will rise to over £20,000 a year when she turns 13.
Obviously, that's one school, but local authorities all over the country are funding children in this situation. Do we have any sense of what social backgrounds those children tend to come from and how mixed it is?
It's really difficult to look at good data around dyslexia diagnoses in relation to income and class because dyslexia diagnoses aren't collated by the government. All we can really do is look at the circumstantial evidence. For example, there's 13 specialist dyslexia schools who are listed on the Helen Arkell Dyslexia Charity's website. And more than half of them are based in either London or Surrey, the two wealthiest counties in the UK, and none of them are based in the 10 most impoverished counties in the UK.
The data you're talking about certainly suggests that there is a big inequality here. It's kind of a narrative that you often hear that seems to finger point at parents in this situation, perhaps, for going down these routes. In the past, I've written about education, and I've written in particular about parents with autistic children going through processes like this. And one of the things that always stunned me was that the local authorities will fight tooth and nail to prevent some of these children from getting access to the schools that they might want to get to. We'll talk about equalising the system, but isn't the system set up by the local authorities in a way to make it much more difficult for poorer children? If they didn't put up the top barristers, if they said that everyone had to represent themselves, if they didn't require these expensive private diagnoses, wouldn't that make a big difference?
I think that's a really fair point. And I think that it's absolutely not my intention to characterise these parents as sort of grifters who are trying to game the system in order to get extra help for their children at the expense of everyone else. But I also think that if 10% of the population of this country are dyslexic, there simply is not enough money in our school budgets to send all of those children to private dyslexia placements. And neither should we really have to. I mean, all of the experts that I've spoken to agree that dyslexic children should be able to be accommodated within mainstream schools with extra support from SENCOs, who are special educational needs coordinators if need be. And the purpose of these tribunals and the reason they were set up was really to help people with pretty severe needs where the state was not meeting their needs. So although it may feel to a parent who has a child whose self-esteem has been completely destroyed by the system, who, you know, is really far behind their peers, although it may seem to that parent that their child's needs are the most severe and the most immediate and the most pressing, actually, when you look at what those tribunals were set up for, it was for children who had really severe and complex needs.
And look, as part of your reporting, you obviously met professionals who are working in this area, and the data you're talking about certainly suggests that there is a big inequality here. Tell me about some of the people you met. Did they see that in their work?
So I met an educational psychologist at University College London called Vivian Hill. Very friendly, very bookish, gives off a definite academic vibe, much more so than Jo Elliott. And in addition to her work as an academic, she's also often called upon to consult on tribunal cases. And she told me about two cases that she worked on that came before tribunal at the same time. One of them involved a child who had moderate dyslexia, but otherwise no other coexisting conditions. And the second tribunal case she worked on involved a child that was really severely disabled. He was pre-verbal. He needed help going to the toilet. He lived with a single mother on the top floor of a council flat in London. And this child really seriously needed a lot of help from his local authority to meet his special educational needs. And Vivian, with her own words, said to me that it was with great horror that she saw that the child who was dyslexic got the extra support and the funding from their local authority. And the child who was pre-verbal, couldn't go to the toilet on their own, lived in a council flat, did not get any support. And the reason for that was because that child's parent couldn't afford lawyers and educational psychologists, and so they lost the tribunal.
I mean, that is shocking. Absolutely shocking that that single mum wasn't able to get support for her child. But basically, of course, resources are rationed, but we still want all children with any difficulties to get the support they need. We're not in a situation where we want to pit parents against each other. We're in a situation where we want all children with difficulties to get support. And I suspect that all the different people that you were speaking to want that outcome. Is that what you felt?
Yes, absolutely. And I think just to quickly jump in on that point about it was terrible that mother didn't get support. Absolutely terrible. But unfortunately, since the coalition government came in 2010, there's been huge cuts to local authority budgets. And it does mean that people are having to make really quite awful decisions about which child gets support. I mean, since 2015, £5.4 billion has been cut from England school budgets, which means that not everyone is going to get support. So really, people like Joe think that you need to prioritise the most severe and the most extreme cases of need. And unfortunately, that means that perhaps a child with dyslexia doesn't get that funding because there is a child who those parents can't see that does need that money more. But I would also say that really what I found the most remarkable about reporting this story for over a year is how much similarity there is between people on both sides of the debate. If anything, they probably agree with each other rather more than they would like to admit. When I spoke to the British Dyslexia Association, they said that the system is not working at the moment, and they acknowledged that. They said it's not right that parents who can afford to fight can fight and the parents who can't afford to fight can't fight. And then on the other side of the debate, you know, Joe is also saying that we really need to focus on the children who aren't even having their literacy needs recognised in the classroom, possibly because they're from a low-income background or they're a racial minority and people just assume that they're stupid or lazy or truanting from school. So everyone agrees that we need to do something about this problem. We need to do something about the fact that 20% of children have literacy needs.
Coming up, has one council found a solution? Are there any examples across the country where local authorities are doing things that seems to be moving in the right direction on this?
So Cambridgeshire, which is not a wealthy local authority by any stretch of the imagination and has really high levels of deprivation and poverty, has been doing really remarkable work around literacy and dyslexia. And what they did basically was quite similar to what the Staffordshire and Warwickshire educational psychologists tried to do back in 2018, but Cambridgeshire were a little bit more savvy about it. So Staffordshire and Warwickshire got into a lot of trouble with the British Dyslexia Association for taking the word dyslexia out of their policy guidance, whereas what Cambridgeshire has done has said, hey, if you want to call your child dyslexic, that's totally fine. If you want to get a diagnosis for your child of dyslexia, that's also totally fine, but it won't affect how we treat your child. What we're going to do is we're going to help all children who are struggling to read and write, regardless of whether or not they have a dyslexia diagnosis. And so last November, gosh, it feels like a long time ago now, pre-COVID, I went up to Cambridgeshire and I sat in on a training day where they basically pulled together all of their special educational needs coordinators into a room and they explained the science of dyslexia to them. And more importantly, they explained what you actually really need to do to help children who are struggling to read and write. When I went up to Cambridgeshire, I met with Dr. Joanna Stanbridge, who is an educational psychologist at Cambridgeshire County Council. And she has really been pushing in this new approach. Joanna is, how can I describe her? She's the sort of person who gives you a hug when you met her, even if you don't really know her.
Not anymore.
Yeah. And she is so passionate about social justice. And that's what really why she brought in this new approach.
If you can read and you can write, the world is opened up to you. Such a barrier not being able to read and write, and everyone needs to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And it can't be contingent on the system, which means that there are steps that some people just can never get past to access support and understanding.
So after I went to Joanna's training day, she took me for a drive around Fenland, which is the most deprived borough of Cambridgeshire. And then we went to a school to meet with Viley, who is a child with dyslexia, severe literacy needs, however you want to define it, who had really been struggling in school. And I met Viley and his mum Louise at their primary school, and it was actually World Book Day on the day we met, which was quite a nice coincidence. So Viley was wearing a onesie and he had big tortoiseshell glasses.
So today's World Book Day, right?
Yeah.
Did you bring a book with you?
Yeah.
What book is it?
It's a Batman one.
I asked him about his reading and I asked him about his books.
How did it make you feel?
when you started to
a bit stress.
Yeah.
And worried and
yeah. Used to get upset, didn't you? He used to come out of school crying sometimes when he started to find it really difficult and say he didn't want to come anymore.
Normally when I'm in the morning, every single day, I tell my stepdad that I don't want to get up.
No, I'm sorry. And is that because you were just worried about what was going to happen?
And I was also tired.
He told me that he feels like he's been doing much better now. He's been getting extra support from Cambridge's special educational needs coordinators under this new approach.
Do you feel like your reading and writing is better now?
Yeah.
And why do you think it's better?
Because I used to do scruffy handwriting, but now I can actually do joined up.
Yeah.
And all that. And my reading has improved. And now I'm in the library getting books.
Doesn't that new approach cost loads of money? Because you've got to pay for more kids who don't have labels.
No, this is a very cost-effective approach, according to all of the educational psychologists that I spoke to. They don't charge schools to send their special educational needs coordinators to these training days. And what they also say is that although it might be a bit more of an investment right now in training up all of these people to go out and look at the best practice for literacy provision in Cambridgeshire, the hope is that it will pay off in the future. It will pay dividends in terms of children not needing to go to tribunal, not needing expensive placement in private dyslexia schools. And so the hope is that this will pay itself back.
Has it been an equaliser in Cambridge?
Not yet. It's 2019, they rolled out this new guidance. Cambridgeshire is still paying to send kids to private dyslexia schools. Legally, it has to. And if you actually plot the distribution of where these kids at private dyslexia schools live on a map, 80% of them live in either Cambridge City Centre or South Cambridge, which are the two wealthiest parts of the county. And none of them come from Fenland, which is the least wealthy part of Cambridge. So, not yet.
Shirin, it feels to me that even just reporting on this has been a bit like kicking a hornet's nest. And in a way, I'm not surprised because these are issues that people feel very deeply about. It's about children's opportunities. It's about inequality. It's about how we parent. What did you expect when you began this? And given such a huge range of views out there, what did you take away from it?
So when I started reporting this, I thought this was going to be a story about science and education. And actually, when it came down to it, I realised this was really a story about social justice. Really, at the heart of this story is the child in the room that no one is paying attention to. It's the child who is being ignored by their teachers, who think that they're lazy and stupid and they're just not working hard enough. And I guess that child was sort of my imagined focus for this piece. Like, how can we get to an educational system where that child's needs, their literacy needs are being met? But what has also been quite hopeful and promising for me is seeing that there might be a path forward out of this morass. And if you look at the example of Cambridgeshire, it's really quite imaginative and bold thinking. And possibly, if it all goes well and other local authorities follow their lead, we might be in the situation of 10 or 20 years' time where more children are having their literacy needs met, regardless of whether or not they have a dyslexia diagnosis.
Shirin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Shirin Carley. She has written so much great stuff for The Guardian, including this piece called The Battle Over Dyslexia. She's also been part of the brilliant reporting project Lost to the Virus, looking in depth at the lives of people who have died after contracting COVID-19. We featured her reporting about the transport worker Belly Majinga on Today in Focus, and I would definitely recommend listening to that episode if you haven't done yet. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.